This is the Furled Sail Sailing Podcast. This is show 143, Marvin Creamer. Today is the 28th September, 2008.
Hi, this is Christy.
And this is Noel.
Welcome to Furled Sails, the world's first sailing podcast. Our show notes are located at www.furledsails.com. Well, this week we talked with Marvin Creamer. Okay, well, it wasn't this week. It was a while ago. But he was an interesting guy. He's the only guy to circumnavigate using no instrumentation whatsoever, not even a watch. So here's the interview, and we hope you enjoy it.
Okay, this is Marvin Creamer. I sailed a small boat around the world with no compass, clock, or sextant.
So when did you start sailing?
I started sailing when I was a teenager. My brother and I bought a rowing skiff, put lee boards on it, stepped a mast in it, a cedar pole out of a swamp nearby, bought some muslin in the penny store, made our own sail. Obviously, we didn't have money to buy the materials for a real sailboat, but it sailed, and it did fairly well on a small lake. And then a buddy of mine built a 12-foot class boat. I can't remember what the class was, and we sailed that in the Delaware River. Then I went a long, long spell with no sailing, but a lot of outboarding. Then around 1969 or 70, I went to a family picnic, and my cousin had a couple of small sailboats, and I got the bug and got the itch and got started into some serious sailing.
What is it about sailing in boats that you love?
I guess the answer is that they're there. But I like the acceleration under quiet power. There's something magical about that. When the wind picks up and your sails fill, they have a kind of a sensuous look about them, the curves, and there's a feeling that you're going somewhere and something nice is going to happen.
Can you give us a quick overview of your voyage?
Yes. We left Cape May, New Jersey on the 21st of December, 1982. We left in an advancing cold front, completely overcast sky. Temperatures were in the teens. Winds were of gale force, and yet we considered that to be ideal conditions for takeoff because we were going to get sea room immediately. Oh, by the way, it was after dark, too.
Well, better to see the lights, right?
Yes. Then the first leg was from Cape May, New Jersey to Cape Town, South Africa. We got there the 31st of March. We had a transmitter that tracked us. It did not tell us where we were, but it did tell people back home through satellites where we were. Spent 8 weeks in Cape Town getting some repairs, making a few small changes on the deck with 4 stays and getting provisions. And then the next leg was from Cape Town to Africa to Hobart in Tasmania, Australia, Indian Ocean in the wintertime. And we were faulted by the people at the Royal Yacht Club at Cape Town for doing that in the wintertime. Actually, when I pinned them down, only one person had ever been across the Indian Ocean at the Cape Town Club, and that was on a merchant vessel. So they really didn't know too much about the conditions in the Indian Ocean between Africa and Australia. Turned out it wasn't too bad a voyage. It was a little rough on the Gullis Bank south of Africa, but other than that, it was okay. We had to make a northern venture to the Great Australian Bight to fix our position before we went into Hobart. But did that. Went, by the way, we went into the lower end of the Derwent River in 40-foot seas. That took a little doing, but we managed okay.
Were the waves breaking on the bar?
No, that we did not have breaking waves. That we avoided. But the cray fishermen were holed up in D'Entrecasteaux Channel because of the foul weather. And when we sailed in with the 40-foot seas, they were impressed that we came in those seas, and more impressed that we came in without instruments. And so they threw us a big, big party. It was fun. Then we were escorted up to Hobart, 80 miles inland up the Derwent River. We spent 6 weeks in Hobart, 42 nights there. We were able to accept 36 invitations to dinner. Okay, from Hobart, we came back down the Derwent River, ran into 90-mile-an-hour winds the first night out. In the morning, we returned all but upside down. Went from there, changed plans. Our plan in leaving Hobart was to go directly to Chile, but one of my crew decided he didn't want to do that, and so we dropped him off in Sydney. Spent a week in Sydney, again, getting a few minor repairs, and then we shipped over to New Zealand, a two-week trip across the Tasman Sea. Then after a week in New Zealand, we headed straight for the Horn, past Cape Horn on the 16th of December, 1983. Got into a heavy three-day blow, but were able to get into the Falkland Islands after the blow was over. Spent 8 weeks in the Falklands, and then from there returned to Cape May, New Jersey.
So how did you get the idea for this voyage?
Now, do you mean the voyage or doing it without instruments?
Well, how about doing it without instruments? Because that wasn't your first trip without instruments, right?
No. The urge to sail around the world came at 17 by reading Jack Hanna's article on the Tahiti Catch. I think it was in Mechanics Illustrated. But the idea to do it without instruments wasn't until I had gotten on the ocean in 1974. I was 58 at the time, rather. Had sailed over the Azores with one crew. They flew home, and I got a buddy to come over and help me double-hand my boat Scotia back from the Azores to Cape May. Well, I had electromechanical self-steering, and about a week out of the Azores, we got brushed by a hurricane, and it racked up the self-steering. Well, that meant then that we had 12 hours each on the tiller, and gradually the compass light deteriorated. The sockets, the splices in the wires, the bulbs themselves, connectors, all failed one night after another, and I got so overworked on a particular day that I decided we were going to use the stars at night. Well, that seemed to work okay. When I worked up the noon position, I found that sailing by the stars at night was about as accurate as sailing with a compass. Well, that then began to turn the wheels. So while I was sitting out there thinking about this, mulling it over, the thought occurred to me that I wonder if we could find a way to get steering direction in the daytime the way we're doing it at night. And that idea just set the hook, the barb. I was a prisoner for 10 years with that idea. And it all began when the compass light failed night after night. Well, I got to thinking about it on the return then from the Azores to Cape May. And it wasn't long before I had decided that waves are pretty constant. The winds will shift waves, but it takes them a long time to do it. Waves ultimately changed, but I figured that we could use them and figure out the amount of change in the direction by just observing the new waves interfacing with the old waves, and that seemed to work okay. By the time I got back to Cape May, I was very comfortable This is 3 weeks later. Very comfortable with the idea of finding direction in the daytime. And then there was a kind of a leap into the next step. I wonder if we could figure out a way to get latitude without a sextant. So that was an entirely new field, but it seemed to be appropriate to think about it. And I tried all sorts of schemes for finding a latitude, but ultimately decided that the only reference point that would be usable would be the imaginary zenithal point. I would have to imagine the point at the top of the sky and then compare transiting stars past that point. And once I got that idea, the trial runs in my front yard in Glassboro, New Jersey, seemed to improve in accuracy. And then I realized that there was a random error, and then came up with some sky geometry to get latitude by using the zenithal method. You should be able to tell when a star is on the meridian on your north-south line. Well, the problem was how to tell when it was on the meridian without a clock. Because by this time, I had decided if I'm ever going to do this, I'm going to do it with no instruments whatsoever, including a radio, because a radio will give you time, and if you have time, you can time sunrises and sunsets, and that gives you a line of position, or each of those would give you a line of position, and that would be a kind of an instrument. So anyway, the sky geometry involved using the polar point, which is pretty easy in the northern hemisphere because the Polaris is very close to the polar point. And I would use a rising star coming from the east, an imaginary line between it and Polaris, and then when that line between a particular star and Polaris divided the sky into two equal parts, that had to be meridian transit. Then it was just a matter of judging the arc distance between that star and the overhead point. It sounds preposterous to think that you can pick a zenithal point with any accuracy, but I packed up the boat and sailed it over to Ireland in 1978, and it worked. We were sighted by two ships whose ID we got and copied down into our log, and each of those ships gave us the exact same latitude. The Stavanger out of Oslo gave us the position 1,200 miles from the Jersey shore, said we were at 40 degrees 19 minutes north. Now, we were trying to stay at 40 degrees 15 minutes north, and so we were only 4 miles off of what I call our project latitude. 800 miles closer to the Jersey shore, 400 miles from the beach, we were sighted by the Alabama Getty out of Delaware City, Delaware, and they gave us the exact same latitude, 40 degrees, 19 minutes north. So in 800 miles of ocean travel, I'm sure we wandered back and forth, but at least we got back to the same latitude that we had been sighted at 800 miles earlier. So we hit the beach within 15 miles of the latitude that we had in our log. And when I got back home, my wife said, "Well, I guess you've proved your point, haven't you?" I said, "Honey, it could have been a fluke. I'm going to have to try it again." And so I did try it again. I went to Africa back in 1980. And I was able to find the Cape Verde Islands on the way back and Bermuda, and was told by Atlantic City PR people who wanted the PR out of that trip to be 9 miles, or rather 5 miles off Absecon Inlet at 9 o'clock in the morning. I can't remember exactly what day it was now, but anyway, I was there, even though we didn't have the clocks on board. And it was at the reception given by one of the casinos in Atlantic City that Joanne Fishman, boating editor, New York Times, asked me about sailing around the world without instruments. And it's always the simulated index finger into the chest saying, "Professor, do you have any plans to sail around the world without instruments?" I said, "No, Mrs. Fishman, I do not." She said, then after thinking for a couple of seconds, she said, "Can you honestly say you haven't thought about it?" No, I couldn't say that because I had thought about it. And the problem was, how do you get around Cape Horn, some of the nastiest water in the world, in complete overcast? Now, how I come to know that it was complete overcast, I had run into a couple of scientists working in Antarctica, and they had been to Antarctica 21 times each. I had met them at Explorers Club in Philadelphia, said, "How many nights a month can I expect to see stars at Cape Horn?" And in a knee-jerk response, each one shoved one finger right up into the air. They didn't even look at each other. And okay, now we got a problem. How are you going to do it? How can you tell that you're safe in complete overcast? And the current runs to 2 knots down there. In a day's time, you're going to be 50 miles closer to rocks that you might not want to be close to. So that took a while. I spent, I would say, close to 6 months part-time in the living room mulling it over. My wife, I'm sure, thought I was asleep, but I kept pounding away. How can I do it? How can I do it? There's got to be a way. And finally, I found a way. And I talked to people, talk to me about bravery and courage. I don't know anything about that. All I know is that once that idea hit, how I could get around Cape Horn in complete overcast, I had to go try it. It would have taken far more courage to stay home than to go.
Okay, I'm dying. What is the method?
Okay. It's what I call the non-occurrence of darkness method, which sounds a little obscure, I'm sure. I found, and I looked at all the literature I could get a hold of, including sailing directions and meteorological information, climatological information, and found in reading the Nautical Almanac that there's a two-week period at the latitude of Cape Horn and farther south when the sun will set, twilight begins, and twilight ends with sunrise without any complete darkness during the night. Now, that's a week each side of the December solstice. In other words, between the 15th and the 29th of December. Now, if I could time the trip to be at the southern tip of South America at that magical two-week period, then I wouldn't have to see any stars. I wouldn't have to see the sun. I wouldn't have to see anything if I had a completely cloudy sky. All I would have to know is that it didn't get completely dark during the night, and that's the way it worked. Now, I didn't leave it to chance. I always took, going across New Zealand to the Horn, I always took the dark to daylight watch, and each morning at twilight, I would look at the shadows on the waves, the wavelets, the cusps on the water, study the dark and the light, and I made up mental keys that I could use in heavily overcast sky, mildly overcast sky, and clear sky. So I had those. I didn't have to depend on looking horizontally through to the horizon. I could look down at the water and tell whether there was twilight or not. I had that fixed in my head from the 7 weeks that I spent sailing across the Pacific.
Now, let me ask you a question going back to the initial start where you went from stars to using the wave patterns.
Yeah.
Did you just use the stars to fix the waves direction when the sun came up in the morning?
Yes. Either pole stars or sunrise in the morning. And then, of course, at night, we got our fix with sunset or with a pole star. Now, you probably understand that when you get near the equator, haze covers the horizon, so that you lose the pole star before you get to the equator. And then in the southern hemisphere, there's no star at the polar point. You have to improvise there. And later on, if you'll ask me about it, I'll tell you what the Boy Scouts of Tasmania contributed to the trip by showing me how to find the pole star or the polar point in the southern hemisphere.
So what did your wife and friends think of this plan to sail around the world with no instruments?
You sure you want to hear?
Absolutely.
Well, that bad, huh?
My wife was not thrilled. I won't say we scrapped over it at all. It wasn't that. There were discussions for at least 3 months. And when it came down to the final decision-making, she pulled out what I called her big gun in the battle, and that was, look, you're the best friend I ever had. Why would I want to do without your company for a year and a half? Well, at that point, I felt I needed my big gun, and my big gun was, and this is dirty pool, and I recognize it, would you really want to live with a guy whose dream died inside of him?
Ooh.
That is heavy.
Wow.
I realize it's heavy, but it's the way I felt. And I was really on fire. Like I said, I was taken prisoner by an idea in the middle of the Atlantic, in the middle of the night, in 1974. And I was the prisoner of that idea for 10 years. And I really was. I was.
At that point, how long had y'all been married?
Let's see, this would have been 82. We were married in 46. So what's that, 36 years?
Yeah.
Her response in saying okay was not real strong affirmative. She said, don't expect the help with provisioning that you've got in the past. Now, I knew she was lying. I think she knew she was lying. And I think she knew that I knew that she was lying, because she was a wonderful help. For example, we had to coat our canned goods with wax to keep the salt water from rusting the cans through. And I knew from experience that that would happen. So she got a crew together and supervised tearing off labels and waxing over the kitchen stove, a pot of boiling wax, 40 cases of canned goods. And she helped can the beef, which I took on board. By that time, I'd gotten addicted to canned hamburg. It's so versatile at sea and so welcome in taste. So she helped with that and everything she worked on. A real Trojan for helping out. So, and she did fly to Tasmania at the middle of the trip, spent 3 weeks with me there, and brought 180 pounds of gear that I needed.
Okay, sounds like a trooper, regardless of her misgivings.
I hate to tell you this. At the homecoming reception, National Park, New Jersey, I think it was May the 20th, 1984, she got a bigger hand from the crowd than I did. And deservedly so.
So can you tell us about Globestar?
Globestar was called a Goderich 35, designed by Ted Brewer when he was in partnership with Bob Wallstrom. I think their business was in Maine at that time. Wallstrom and Brewer split up. Wallstrom got the royalty rights for the boat. It was built primarily in Goderich, Ontario, by the Huromic, H-U-R-O-M as in Marvin, I-C, steel company, and Bob Patterson got into doing that when a friend of his wanted to build a steel boat, and Bob had room in his factory for his friend to use as a place for the work. So he got into it and then got into these 35s, and apparently he put out quite a few of them, mostly for freshwater use. It was theoretically a double chine boat, but Bob Patterson rolled the plates and rolled them so well that it would have been impossible except for an absolute dyed-in-the-wool naval designer to tell that it wasn't a round-bottom boat. It had very fair curved lines, a very beautiful boat. And I had the, instead of the hard seams on the cabin top, I had had them split pipe, round pipe, and so the all the edges of the cabin top were rolled, the gunnels were rolled the same way. Very trim, beautiful-looking boat.
A full keel design? What did she look like?
Full keel, yes. Well, a bit of a cutaway forefoot. Other than that, it came right back to the rudder.
Okay. What made you choose that for your voyage?
I looked all over for seaworthy boats, and I got into all the mathematical ratios and constants, most of which I've forgotten. Talked to people about the manufacturers about their fiberglass boats, and when they heard that I was going to be exposed to potential crashes on the icebergs or rocks, they sort of steered me away from their boats. But there was a manufacturer in the Lippincott Company in Riverside, New Jersey, that steered me toward the Gyrich 35. They said, it's a great design and a reputable designer, and I think it'll do what you want it to do. And so I investigated and decided that it was okay. Now, I did have the cabin extended. It had more cockpit than I wanted, especially in view of the fact that we would get dumping waves and filling with seawater. I didn't want that weight might make us wallow around a bit. I did shorten the mast a little because I could get a mast in one piece without extending, and 11 and a half inches shorter than the original, but not all that bad for going through the Southern Oceans, because you need a tall mast to go across the equator, but a boat can be coaxed across the equator with a shorter mast, but I think a real tall mast in the Southern Oceans is a bit hazardous. We did get turned down at one time. The mast went down to the water and then rotated another 50 degrees, and we were under upside down long enough for broken glass to be cemented by the milk that was in the glass container to the headliner. 2 days later, I saw a nest of glass up overhead that was cemented there by the milk in the container at the time we were rolled down.
That had to take, what, 20 minutes or something?
It wasn't that long. It seemed like forever. But I have no idea. See, we didn't have any clocks. I wouldn't have timed. I'm just too scared to time it anyway. Salty Niagara Falls was coming in the hatch. It had the wave had shoved the hatch forward, so the water was pouring in. It was not a great scene, but we were able to pump it out and get on with it. It really didn't, aside for some minor damage, it didn't really deter us at all, except it did induce one crew from the Chesapeake to leave us.
Go back to warmer water?
Yeah, that turned out not to be totally bad, because he did not want to go around the Horn. He wanted to be dropped off in Chile. And to drop him off in Chile would have required time, so much time that we would not have made our appointment with the Horn in that magical 2-week period. Mm-hmm. So it was not a total loss. I do not regard it as any kind of a disaster. He decided he wanted out. We dropped him off in Sydney. Then Nick Gill and I, the Tasmanian who was in the crew, volunteer, and I sailed to New Zealand. And in New Zealand, we were able to pick up a third crew by just arriving. Bob Rout showed up Sunday while we were talking to the customs people and took us back to dinner 45 minutes away. He brought us back Sunday night, said goodbye, and showed up Monday morning volunteering to sail to the Falklands with us. I was a little concerned. I wondered if he really knew what he was asking. I said, "Bob, you know that we're headed for the Horn with no instruments whatsoever." And he came back with, "You got this far, didn't you?"
Yeah.
I couldn't argue with that. He turned out to be the best crew we had. Remarkable sailor. He could take down a loaded jenny, keep the boat on course, take down a loaded jenny, drop it on the deck, fold it up, almost like he was folding a napkin at the dinner table. Good cook and nice guy. By the way, he is now an international irrigation water-finding engineer. I talked to him a couple of months ago. He was in Iran drilling wells, and he had appointments in Bulgaria, Sudan, and Ethiopia.
Well, that's getting around.
Yeah.
Okay. So what changed about, you know, your plans for how you were going to navigate? What changed once you were out at sea?
You mean the idea to sail without instruments?
Well, I was thinking more along the lines of methods.
Not too much change. We had that pretty well figured out. The only thing that we hadn't figured out was a good way or an easy way to find a polar point in the southern hemisphere. I took the distance between two stars in the Southern Cross, Gacrooks and Acrooks, and multiplied 4.5 times that distance on a line skyward toward the zenith from those two stars to find the polar point. Now, that was essential to our finding latitude. And without latitude, you couldn't tell the amplitude of the sun for finding direction at sunrise or sunset. So it was essential that we have that. Well, when I got to Tasmania, a scoutmaster asked if I would talk to his troop. Certainly I'll talk to the troop. Well, I got more from the troop than they got from me, because they told me how to find the polar point using a very novel method. They used Gacrooks and Acrooks in the Southern Cross, but there are two stars off to the side of the Southern Cross, Hadar and Rigel Kent. They happen to be on the same parallel, and they're set at some modest distance from the Southern Cross. Well, the Gacrooks and Acrooks are on the same meridian. Hadar and Rigel Kent are on the same parallel. Well, if you erect a perpendicular to a parallel, in other words, Hadar and Rigel Kent, you now have an imaginary meridian. And because it's set at an angle with that of Gacrooks and Acrooks, you can actually cross in the sky, in your imagination, those two lines and get the polar point. It was a wonderful idea, and in the end, it saved us days of sailing time, and it made possible to find a polar point when all we could see was that little chunk of the sky. The rest of the sky could be totally overcast. Even the polar point could be overcast, and we were still able to get the point in the sky that we needed for navigation.
Okay. That's cool.
and it was fun. It was fun to think about the scouts all during the rest of the trip. I was very thankful to them, because most of the time in the Southern Hemisphere, the sky is cloudy, and especially at night. And all we needed was those. And Hadar and Rigel Kent are very bright stars. And Gacrooks and Acrooks are bright stars. So you had this little corner of the sky, and you had the polar point zip, and it really was a very comforting bit of information.
So can you tell us about the creaking hatch?
Oh, that was a that was a fun thing. We were sailing between Africa and Australia, and of course we got direction going into cloudy weather from the sky, either the sun or stars or moon, planets, and then we held that direction during the cloudy weather until we got some further notice of direction change. Okay, well, on one occasion, we went into the cloudy weather, okay, but then the wind quit. Well, and the sky remained cloudy. Well, that wasn't any big deal because without wind, you weren't going anywhere, and therefore you didn't need direction. But after a period of time, I think it was at least a half a day or more, of sitting still, the wind began to blow. Now you've got the ideal conditions for sailing. Smooth surface and good wind. No, but no direction. Oh, dear. So I sat in my bunk, Buddha-like, cross-legged, trying to rake an idea out of my brain for direction. And one of the crew, and I don't know if it was Nick Gill or Bob Rout, pushed the hatch forward. It made a horrendous squeak. Not unlike your fingernails coming down a blackboard, only with 10 times the volume. And bingo, it was just like a light bulb went off in my head. I didn't have to think about it. It was automatic. I knew immediately that the wind was off Antarctica, and that to go east, we had to put the boat on the starboard tack.
How did you know the squeak meant off Antarctica?
Okay. I'll give you the history of the squeak. The original hatch stop was Teak, but on the way to between Cape May and Cape Town, that battering of closing the hatch had split the Teak stop, and the hatch flew into the cockpit. Well, I made a temporary stainless steel metal stop, but when I got to South Africa, I replaced it with plywood. The plywood was very coarse-grained. Now, the hatch runners were stainless steel, and when the end grain of the plywood rubbed on the stainless steel, it made a squeak, and I knew that it squeaked, but I had never thought about why it squeaked when it did and why it didn't squeak when it didn't squeak. I had never given any thought to that at all, but this is the way it worked out. If the wind were from the equator in the southern hemisphere, it would be a warm wind, and it would be carrying a lot of moisture, and the moisture would lubricate the wood, keep it lubricated, and therefore no squeak. But if a hatch squeaked, it was because the wood was dry, and the wood could only be dried by a dry wind, and the dry wind would only come from Antarctica. Now, this is a lifetime of teaching geography and having courses in meteorology and oceanography and that sort of thing, but I knew that the air, dry air, could only come from the south, and if you're going east, you put a south wind on the starboard to do it. And by the way, we were probably 15 degrees off our desired course when we got sky, but if you know the laws of tangents, that doesn't mean that you've lost that much time on long boards, as they say in sailing, long tacks.
Right.
So it worked out very well.
Now, how did the color of the sea help you navigate?
The sea generally is blue or gray in response to the sky, but in shallower waters, the plankton tend to turn the water green. And I was curious about the change in water color between the Pacific and Atlantic ahead of time. So I sought out a figurehead officer on a boat in Philadelphia Harbor. It had been converted to a restaurant, and they kind of had a figurehead from the old sea sailing days, and he had been around the Horn. So I approached him and asked him about water color, and he was pretty clear that the water in the Pacific was a lighter green than the water in the Atlantic. It was a darker green. So that idea was in my mind when we got through to that area. But we had another good clue at the southern tip of South America. We got a very cold rain shower from the north. Now, you wouldn't expect cold air from the north in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, but if you happen to be south of the continent of South America, where the Andes rise up and are snow-covered, then you could expect cold air in a shower. So we used not only watercolor there, but we did use cold air. The air was cold enough to condense our breath in the cabin. And we hadn't seen that on the whole trip. That was the only time on the whole trip, and we saw air that cold. So we knew immediately then that we were at the southern tip of South America. By the way, we saw stars for latitude only five times in the 5,000 miles across the Pacific, and corrected with each sighting, on average a sighting every 1,000 miles. But the first rocks that we saw on the morning of December 15th, 1983, were on the exact latitude of Cape Horn. We had crossed 5,000 miles from New Zealand to Cape Horn and hit our target dead on.
It's amazing.
I'd like to think some of it was good management, but of course a lot of it was just plain good luck. They were 60 miles, each Los Ildefonso were 60 miles due east of Cape Horn and on the exact latitude of Cape Horn. By the way, our water pump failed in the engine. It was only a year and a half old. It was new and brand new when we started out. But all six blades of the water pump impeller broke off, jammed in the output, and I had to shut the engine down. We had to change from a downwind rig to a pointing rig, but we managed to veer off. I think we had about a mile to spare from the rocks.
I got to say, that's one heck of a feat of navigation to hit it dead on like that. I think that I really, the only thing I can think of that reminds me is Slocum tying his tiller off and sailing across the Pacific and making landfall without touching it.
I tried to figure out how Slocum did that, but I was never able to do it. I had to have some kind of self-steering gear. he was a genius at that. And then his one hand alarm clock that he used.
Yeah.
Said he lost one hand off the alarm clock. But he was pretty good navigator. I think he used lunar distances that had tables. I think the Navy had tables at that time and used lunar distances. And then not only did he tie the tiller off, when he went through the Straits of Magellan, he tied his boat to scrub growth so it wouldn't be blown on a lee shore by the katabatic winds there.
But then he almost hit those rocks.
Yeah. It was reading Slocum that gave me the idea that I didn't really want to go through the Straits of Magellan.
I can see that.
I'm a great believer in sea room, and the Drake Passage has got 100 mile width to it, so you got a little leeway there, and that's what I was aiming for. We got direction the first night. We sailed off in the dark in a completely overcast sky. We got direction by just feeling the wind on the back of our necks. The wind was out of the northwest. We wanted to go southeast, so we just balanced the wind between left ear and right ear and sailed downwind. And I'll never forget the constellation Cassiopeia came up showing us where the North Star was about 1 o'clock. And then I say about 1 o'clock because we had no clocks. But about 1 o'clock there it was. What a glorious feeling to have the trip underway and to be right on target with your direction.
Right.
In conditions that were most people would not consider to be ideal.
Terrifying would be the word. What do birds tell you?
All right, the birds. Icebergs, or prions, told us that we were in the vicinity of Australia, the south shore of Australia. And diving petrels. The diving petrels look pretty much like the Wilson's petrels of the northern hemisphere. They helped us to get into Falklands, because we knew that they roosted on land at night, and we saw flocks of them, big flocks of them, moving from across our bow from starboard to port. So we knew that land had to be off to starboard somewhere when we found them early in the morning. Now, we ran into a Jaeger after we crossed the equator moving between the Falklands and Cape May, New Jersey. Jaegers are found only way out at sea, so we got sort of course longitude by Jaeger, somewhere around 30 degrees of latitude. And then when barn swallows came in and settled on our stanchion lines and tiller steering lines, we knew that we were getting pretty close to land. And then we used not birds, but for the final measure of closeness to land, we use house flies. When house flies came on board, we knew that land could not be any more than 15 miles away.
So house flies will go out 15 miles.
That's what I understood. We accepted that as gospel.
Yeah, I was just thinking about horse flies. You know, most of the time you'll go out around here and there's these nasty biting horse flies.
Yeah.
But I don't think they fly out to the boat. I think they're hiding somewhere in the boat. Waiting for an unguarded moment.
I went into the dismal swamp one time off the Virginia Cut in the Intracoastal Waterway and got bitten by those flies. My feet were swollen for a week.
And why do they got to bite you on the ankle bone?
Maybe that's where the blood is closest to the skin. I mean, they probably know more about anatomy than we give them credit for.
Am I?
Probably.
We'd like to thank Marvin for taking the time to talk to us. Appreciate it. And part two will be up next week.
We're going to skip the feedback this week. Christy and I have been fighting colds for a good chunk of the month, but we do appreciate the feedback, and we'll try to read it in next week. But we'd like to thank David for his gift of Desperate Voyage. We really appreciate it. We'd also like to thank someone for the gift of the Horatio Hornblower DVDs. The company that mailed it to us didn't put the shipping slip in it, and so I'm not sure who it was, but thank you very much. We're going to greatly enjoy and appreciate it as we watch them. If you'd like to help support the show, there's two ways to do it. There's a PayPal link on furledsails.com over on the right-hand side. We can donate some money. And if you don't want to donate any money, but you'd like to maybe buy us a book, then there's a link to our Amazon wish list full of some sailing books we'd like to read.
Well, thanks for joining us this week. Again, our show notes are located at www.furledsails.com. Email us at podcast@furledsails.com. See you on the water.
See you on the water.